of Rigo versus the State of Nevada, case number 53626. Counsel, are you ready to proceed? Very well.
May it please the court, my name is David Anthony. I represent the appellant, Michael Rippo, in this matter. I would like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, if I may. At Mr. Rippo's trial, the trial attorneys raised a motion to disqualify the trial judge on the grounds of bias. Specifically, there were newspaper reports that had come out saying that the judge was the subject of a federal criminal investigation regarding whether or not he had taken bribes from litigants. On direct appeal, counsel argued that the Clark County District Attorney's Office was involved in a sting operation with the FBI to route cases to the judge's chambers to see if the judge would take bribes from litigants before him.
How does that prejudice your case? Why wouldn't that prejudice the other side?
Well, it prejudices our side because we have a situation where the trial judge is subject to a criminal investigation where one of the parties before him is involved in the criminal investigation. It's our contention that that relationship at least gives rise to a danger that the judge couldn't be impartial when one of the parties to the litigation is investigating him. The second reason why there was a unique situation of bias in this case is these allegations that were raised in a motion for a new trial that involved an individual named Denny Mason. He was the owner of the stolen vehicle and the stolen credit cards that were used allegedly by Mr. Rippo after the murder offense. Again, in a motion for a new trial, they alleged that the trial judge failed to disclose a relationship that he had with Mr. Mason. That claim was rejected, and this court affirmed that finding on direct appeal on the grounds that there was no connection between the victim witness, Mr. Mason, and the trial judge. What we've been able to show the court in this petition is that there actually was a relationship between the federal criminal investigation against the trial judge and the relationship that he allegedly had with Mr. Mason. We've attached as exhibits to this petition a wiretap summary of a phone conversation that was placed from an individual named Ben Spano from the Buffalo La Cosa Nostra to Judge Bongiovanni's chambers, requesting favors in the form of fixing traffic tickets, including for individuals and specifically mentioning Denny Mason. It's our contention that when you look at the totality of the circumstances here, that if the judge had offered the disqualifying facts on the record when this issue was litigated at trial, he would have incriminated himself in the federal criminal investigation for which he was indicted only 1 month after he adjudicated Mr. Rippo's case. In addition,
counsel, for clarification, what you are talking about at this time, was that available at the time of trial?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
The specific things that you are alleging now, were they available at the time of trial when this was first raised?
I can only go on what's in the trial itself. And in the trial itself, trial counsel says that their motions are based upon newspaper reports that are starting to filter out into the public talking about the nature of the federal criminal investigation. So the only information that I'm aware of, or the trial counsel was aware of at the time, were these newspaper reports.
So the wiretap that you're talking about then was not available at that time?
It was not available at that time.
Mr. Anthony, the other thing I wondered about with these newspaper reports, perhaps the judge thought there was no basis for it, because when he did go on trial, he was acquitted. So there might be... it's kind of a subjective thing about what the judge thought. What's your comments on that?
It's certainly true that the judge was tried in 1997 and also in 1998. He was ultimately acquitted of the charges. It's my position that when you look at a claim of judicial bias, there's an argument to be made that an innocent man has just as much to fear as a guilty man. And that if you look at the facts of this case, the FBI agent and the Metro Intelligence officer who did the search warrant on the judge's home actually located the marked bribe money in his back pocket. So it wasn't a foregone conclusion at the time of Mr. Rippo's trial that the judge would ultimately be acquitted. And even if that was the case, I think there's a good position to make that even an innocent man could be partial under the circumstances, given this influence by the state of Nevada and by the Metro Intelligence officers who were involved in the investigation, and also with respect to the Clark County District Attorney's Office, who were used by the FBI to present a bogus indictment against an individual named Terry Salem, who was a government informant. And the target was supposed to try to solicit bribes from Judge Bongiovanni. It was only 2 months before the start of Mr. Rippo's trial that Mr. Bongiovanni conflicted himself off of Mr. Salem's case on the grounds that it would give rise to an appearance of bias. So we're looking at
Could you pause, though, for a moment? This is this is an appeal from a second post-conviction petition. And the struggle I'm having as I listen to you is, why is this claim not time-barred?
There are two answers to that question, Justice Pickering, one of which is that one theory of good cause to overcome the default rules is that the state suppressed material evidence that would have shown that the claim had merit. Specifically, we have representations by the prosecutor on the record stating that they spoke personally with the district attorney and were informed that the district attorney's office in the state of Nevada had no involvement in the investigation. So the reason that that's a theory of cause is because litigants, like defense counsel, have a right to rely upon the representations that are made by prosecutors, and they have a right to rely on the representations made by the trial judge. When those representations turn out to be untrue later, they don't hold that against the defense attorneys or against Mr. Rippo, because he has a right to rely upon those representations as being true.
When does the record show your client learned that those representations were untrue?
I think that the most devastating evidence, as far as I'm concerned, relates to the evidence that was uncovered from the federal criminal investigation, specifically the trial transcripts that we obtained from the federal court. At that point, there was overwhelming evidence talking about the state's involvement with respect to the district attorney's involvement. And this also brings me to my second theory of cause, which is that...
Before you get there, when did that come to light
exactly?
Well, they were public record. So these were trials that occurred in 1997, and it was a trial that occurred in 1998.
So those were in the public domain at that time?
They were filed in federal court, yes.
Okay, and your second theory of...
Good cause relates to the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. It's our position that effective counsel would have reviewed the briefs on direct appeal. He would have seen these naked allegations that refer to this sting operation by the Clark County District Attorney's Office, and he would have done what we did, which he would have ordered the transcripts from the trial, he would have reviewed them, and then he would have attached them as exhibits to the petition, and he would have requested a hearing.
And so, what standard applies to that claim that first post-conviction counsel was ineffective?
The standard that applies to that claim is, as far as I can tell, identical to the standard that would apply for ineffective assistance of trial counsel. That would require a showing of deficient performance by post-conviction counsel, and it would require a showing of a reasonable probability of a more favorable outcome.
But it's a statutory right, not a constitutional right, that gives him a right to post-conviction counsel in the first place, correct?
It is a statutory...
But you want to put Strickland into that review?
I'm not necessarily asserting that Strickland has to be the same review, but what I am saying is it's the only one we know about. So as far as ineffective assistance standards, there's really no other standard for us to work with other than the Strickland standard. And the Strickland standard does seem to make sense, and it would allow courts to proceed on that issue just as they do on ineffective assistance of trial counsel claims, which is still a high hurdle to prove. And you'd have to prove both hurdles in order to get the claim heard on the merits. As far as the legal standard here, the question is whether or not the facts would cause a reasonable person to question the impartiality of the trial judge. It's our contention that if you put all this together, that we can make the prejudice showing on the ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel claim, because we can show that if post-conviction counsel had sought the federal court transcripts, and if they had sought the Terry Salem criminal case, they would have been able to show the involvement that the district attorney's office had, and also the involvement that Metro Intelligence officers had, and the Nevada Division of Investigation in investigating the trial judge. We can also show from the trial transcripts that the judge was aware that Metro was involved in the investigation, which is important because those allegations are contrary to the representations he made at trial, where he said he didn't know whether Metro was involved. And it's telling on a bias claim that the disqualifying facts aren't revealed by the judge. It tends to indicate that the disqualifying facts do in fact affect the impartiality of Judge Bongiovanni.
Can you go back for a second? You had mentioned that he indicated he didn't know Metro was involved. So obviously there was some discussion about this at the trial.
Correct, Your Honor.
Can you give me an idea as to the extent of that discussion on this particular issue?
Judge Bongiovanni at the federal criminal trials gave very detailed testimony, and he talked about specifically about how John Nicholson from Metro Intelligence.
Okay, this is in his federal prosecution. This wasn't your trial.
Correct, Your Honor.
Okay, never mind.
I'll reserve the rest of my time unless I have questions. Thank you.
Mr. Owens.
May it please the court, I'm Steve Owens of the Clark County District Attorney's Office on behalf of Nevada. Counsel really has just addressed this first issue from his appeal, and that concerns the Judge Bongiovanni on this federal investigation that was, there was hints about it in the media before Ripa went to trial, and then there was additional newspaper articles in the midst of trial. Once Bongiovanni was indicted, that was after the trial was concluded, that's when there was a motion filed for a new trial where there were allegations made about this relationship with Denny Mason, and more specifically with Ben Spano. To my knowledge, Denny Mason, who was one of the victims in this case, a victim of the stolen vehicle, his name was on the vehicle, although it was given by him to one of the deceased victims. We did use him to say that that vehicle did not belong to the defendant and had in fact been stolen. He was also the victim of one of the credit cards that was used by the defendants in this case. But to my knowledge, that victim, Denny Mason, was not involved in the federal investigation. Granted, there's a lot of documents there, a lot of transcript. I didn't get a chance to read the entire federal record of what transpired. I didn't see Denny Mason's name come up. Ben Spano's name, who is a business associate of Denny Mason, his name did come up. He was one small piece of a massive investigation that involved a lot of different allegations of bribes and numerous incidents of purported bribes or favors that were given to defendants. And so really what they're saying here is that Judge Bongiovanni, when it's being reported in the media that there's some federal investigation, he's supposed to know that it involves Ben Spano and that Denny Mason is a business associate, and therefore he should have known to recuse himself off this case. But we're looking at it in hindsight. At the time, it was not clear to anyone what exactly this investigation was about. Certainly, Bongiovanni had been arrested in the midst of that case involving Terry Salem, and that is why he did recuse himself off of Salem's case. But Salem's case has no connection to the Ripa trial. As this court on direct appeal, in ruling on the direct appeal claims as well as the denial of the motion for a new trial, it said that disqualification in the instant case would lead to Judge Bongiovanni's disqualification in all criminal cases he heard while subject to the federal investigation. Such a result would be unsupportable. And that's really the problem here, is that ultimately Judge Bongiovanni was acquitted of these allegations, and what is a sitting judge supposed to do when there is some amorphous federal investigation going on? He may have some knowledge of what parts of it might be about, but until that indictment became unsealed and the federal trial went on, it wasn't known at the time how expansive this was, how many years this investigation and who all the parts and parties of it were. So I think we're trying to attribute too much knowledge to Judge Bongiovanni. And there is certainly nothing that I think has come out here at all that would show that he was biased in this particular case and that he would have to be disqualified in all of his cases if that were the situation.
Mr. Rollins, can you help me? I'm trying to figure out what happened between 97 and 98 and 2008 when this was filed, this incident petition for habeas corpus.
1997 was the direct appeal. There was a first post-conviction petition filed here in state court in 1998. That wound its way in district court. There was an evidentiary hearing. Trial counsel and direct appeal counsel both testified. The first post-conviction petition was denied in district court in 2004. Came to this court on post-conviction appeal, published decision in 2006. And it's after that that the federal public defender becomes involved. And it's then that they purportedly go to the federal record and get these federal documents that they could have gotten at any time. In fact, we know the trial counsel had access to those federal documents, at least some of them, because in the reply brief on direct appeal, they made mention of it.
And that's how Judge Wall finds this issue time-barred, as to what you just might.
Judge Wall found that there was no good cause and prejudice to overcome the procedural bars to entertain this claim on its merits. What specific part of that was his ruling, I don't know, whether he specifically said on that it was good cause as opposed to prejudice. One or the other applied under the procedural bars so that he found that his claim was without.
I think that's what his findings of fact is. I'm just looking at it. Say that it's time barred as of January 15th, 2008, when this is filed.
Right, time barred because either they didn't establish good cause or they were not able to establish prejudice, that Bongiovanni was in fact biased or that they had good cause for not discovering this. I think there is some language in the findings that these were public documents. These were available to defense. They were even mentioned in the reply brief. And so they've always had this information about the relationship and the state's alleged involvement, which, by the way, the allegation is that there was some special agent that talked to a unknown prosecutor about putting a case in front of the grand jury and having it wind up in front of Judge Bongiovanni. This is a year and a half before the Ripple trial. And it was not a bogus indictment, as Mr. Anthony has called it throughout his briefs. It was a legitimate criminal case. This was a federal snitch, somebody who had been committed a bank fraud and was a genuine, actual crime. And yes, at the Fed's direction, we purportedly did file a state prosecution on that. That doesn't make it bogus. It's an actual legitimate crime. To what extent there's this allegation about the manipulation in front of Judge Bongiovanni, that prosecutors do not have that capability to track a case like that. The federal record indicates that the chief judge was consulted at the time. Now, a chief judge would have authority and the power to put a case in front of Bongiovanni. But simply because the DA's office agreed to prosecute a federal snitch for a crime and may have been privy to some knowledge a year and a half before Ripple that there was some sort of federal investigation going on does not make us a joint investigator of Judge Bongiovanni.
Was the Salem case originated by a criminal complaint or an indictment?
Indictment.
Okay, so that would be randomly assigned to the district court judges, like any new case.
That's correct.
Okay.
Somehow it ended up in front of Bongiovanni. The record, even the federal record, does not show exactly how that happened. The affidavit that they're relying on, which I have not actually seen, it's quoted in a defense opposition in the federal court. And that affidavit indicates that 2 weeks before the indictment was had, that the prosecutor said that he could make it happen. It doesn't mean unilaterally. It may have meant in conjunction with the chief judge we could have gotten this case in front of Bongiovanni. But that was 2 weeks before. How it actually played out, we don't know. Somehow the Salem case did end up in front of Bongiovanni, whether it had to be manipulated there or just randomly fell there, we don't know.
But the DA's office had nothing to do with it getting there.
We had nothing to do with an investigation of Bongiovanni. The allegation and from the federal documents is that we may have played some role in having it end up in front of Bongiovanni. I don't know whether that's true or not, but it does not make us co-investigators of Judge Bongiovanni, such that now we are in tandem with the federal investigators investigating Bongiovanni, setting him up for bribes. The fact that we filed a case at the direction of the feds, that happens all the time. All the time they come to us, and we go to them and say, hey, you ought to look at this, take them federally. Or they say, hey, we're not going to do this federally, why don't you take them state? And one of our prosecutors may have had some knowledge that they intended to use this case.
Was there an original criminal complaint before that was assigned to a justice court before the indictment, or was just straight indictment without a criminal complaint being filed?
Straight indictment, to my knowledge. I'm unaware of any pre-existing complaint.
Because I know I raised that issue when I was on the district court bench about sometimes Metro would file something in justice court, not like who was assigned to, and because they would look down to see what district court would go to, and then they would change C-track or whatever it was called. And I raised that issue with Chief Judge Gibbons, and I think we remedied that situation to where everybody got some of the high-profile cases.
Well, the bottom line is that there is really nothing new here some 15 years later that they have discovered about any actual bias on Bongiovanni's part that would allow it now to be considered anew in the context of a second post-conviction petition. Brady does not give them good grounds, nor does ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel, because they've really done and established nothing further that wasn't known by trial counsel on the reply brief from direct appeal, that there was this allegation that we were involved in manipulating the random case and that there was this supposed relationship with Judge Bongiovanni and the witness. Incidentally, in regards to that relationship, this court said that even if the relationship existed, they first said there's no indication, no proof here that there was a relationship, but if there was a relationship that existed with Denny Mason, Ripco has not shown that the judge's alleged acquaintance with Mason's business partner, Ben Spano, would result in bias.
Mr. Owens, let me ask you this. Is there anything about this case, depending on how we rule on it, that you think we should resolve by opinion to clarify certain our jurisprudence on this? Is there anything unique about this case, or what's your thoughts on that?
No, I don't see anything meriting a published opinion. We've really looked at just one of many issues here in the briefs, but I think it would be fairly rare to have a judge under a federal investigation. That doesn't happen very often. I think there is sufficient authority out there to resolve this this issue, and so no, I don't see the need.
Well, Mr. Owens, we haven't specified the period of time within which a second post-conviction petition must be filed. In orders, we've generally focused on a year's period of time, but generally it's been a reasonable time. Would it be appropriate in this case to specify that time in applying the procedural bar?
I definitely would like some clarification on that particular issue. Whether this is the appropriate case to do it in, I don't know. I think there's much more egregious examples of cases out there where it's an extended period of time. I think there's a lot of confusion that there is some per se 1 year after the issuance of remitter from the post-conviction appeal, as if we're starting the one-year time bar over, and we're not. It's not a question of, you know, some sort of grace period. It's really the timeliness focuses on the good cause. Do you have good cause now to come forward with some additional claims? And as part of that good cause analysis, you got to look at the timeliness of it. If they had upon documents or information or knowledge and did not act on it, did not bring it to the state court's attention in a timely manner, then that is not good cause.
Well, what role does ineffective assistance of first post-conviction counsel play in the determination of good cause for delay associated with the second petition? Because that's the essential allegation that they're making as good cause here, is that first post-conviction counsel was ineffective and therefore we should have an indefinite period of time till we get better lawyers to look at this, essentially. And my question is, what would be the standard of evaluating ineffective assistance in that setting? Is it Strickland, as Mr. Anthony says? Is it something else?
Well, that's an interesting issue about whether Strickland applies. I hadn't really thought of it in that context, that this is a statutory right on first post-conviction, not a constitutional right. But I've always, well, I haven't always. It's been an argument made and reevaluated over time, but it appears to me that we have to look on a claim-by-claim basis. If it's ineffective assistance of counsel in failing to raise a certain claim, we have to go look and see how long did they have the knowledge, the basis for that allegation against their post-conviction counsel. And if they waited some unreasonable amount of time, and I don't know if we're going to be able to quantify that, before returning, then it is not good cause because they have unduly delayed. They have to explain good cause for the entire length of the delay. Oftentimes they'll know something for 4 or 5 years in federal court. This isn't one of those cases, but we have many where it's 4 or 5 years. They investigate and develop claims that they know that they have. They've discovered the federal documents or these court records, and they sit on the claims before they return. Here they got back within 1 year, and I certainly don't want to suggest that there is a 1 year grace period. I don't think there is. For certain claims such as some new case authority that has retroactive effect. I don't think you need 1 year to develop that claim to return. You can return immediately to state court and say, hey, there's this new case that came out. I haven't had a chance to litigate that. You don't get to sit on that one for a year and then bring it up on the 364th day to make that claim. I think for that claim, it has to be more timely. So that's how I tend to look at these things, and that's been a developing argument over time, because we don't have a whole lot of clarification from the court as to what the timeliness factor is when assessing that good cause. And so if this is the case where we can make some clarification, then I would welcome it on that issue.
Thank you, Mr. Owens.
Thank you.
Mr. Anthony.
I'd like to start by addressing the questions from Justice Gibbons and Justice Pickering about the issue about whether this has been raised in a timely manner. When this was argued below, Mr. Owens, to his credit, argued the same thing, which is he acknowledged that this was filed within 1 year of the issuance of remitter from the prior post-conviction proceeding. He said that it was done in a timely manner. I certainly agree with him on that point. I also agree with Mr. Owens that there is a sense of confusion about what the time period would be if it wasn't 1 year from the issuance of remitter. If the court looks at 34.726, it talks about 1 year from the issuance of remitter on direct appeal, but it says nothing about good cause coming from issuance of remitter on a post-conviction appeal. This argument that Mr. Owens has made is consistent with what they've argued in other cases, which is they've argued that you have 1 year from the issuance of remitter. Personally, I don't know what other rule the court could establish today other than that rule. There's no other rule that is apparent from Section 726 itself. Before, the court has just said reasonable time, but I am aware that in an unpublished case, in the Floyd case, the court did say that you had 1 year from the issuance of remitter to file a claim of ineffective assistance of post-conviction counsel. I didn't cite that as authority because it's unpublished, but I believe it's relevant to the issue we're talking about here today, which is what would the reasonable time period be? And if it's not a year or if it's less than a year, what would that time period be? And unfortunately, because of the...
What is the source of the 1 year from the issuance of the remitter on the first appeal of the first post-conviction?
Well, the source is the statute, Section 726.
But that's 1 year after entry of the judgment of conviction, or if it was taken from the judgment of conviction from the remitter of that direct appeal. There isn't a statute that I found that addresses 1 year from the date of issuance of the remitter on the first appeal from the first post-conviction.
I think the court is absolutely right. There is no statute, there is no rule that talks about the timeliness of filing a successive petition. So the issue on the table is, what would that time period be?
Why doesn't it just revert over to 800 at that point?
Well, I think that's an interesting argument. I think that 34.800 certainly has a role to play, but when you look at 34.800 as applied to this case, we have a post-conviction proceeding that was filed in 1998, and the remitter didn't issue until January 17th of 2007. So there's still the issue of successor post-conviction counsel couldn't have done anything in that period of, what would that have been, 9 years. And so that needs to be factored in as well. The question is feasibly, what can we expect of a second post-conviction counsel to do? My suggestion is that 1 year of time is at least a presumptively reasonable period of time. If you look at the date of discovery of the documents that I supplied, I discovered those in less than a year before I brought this state petition. And I also filed this state petition before I even filed a federal petition because I wanted to make sure that I met that 1 year deadline. Now, the court may deliberate about what the deadline ought to be, but what we do know is that right now there's confusion about that. And because of that, it would be unfair to retroactively dream up a new rule and to apply it to Mr. Rippo retroactively without notice. So we would argue that a year is appropriate.
Counsel, what specific documents are you alleging that you found that weren't available to the prior counsel?
Well, we allege that they were available to prior post-conviction counsel. And we allege that if he would have gone to the federal courthouse and if he would have gone to the state courthouse, he would have found these documents, and that's our theory for why post-conviction counsel was ineffective. He could have obtained them.
But you don't make an affirmative claim that post-conviction counsel was ineffective. That's tied to your overcoming the time bar, correct?
I'm not sure.
The petition states 22 bases for your second petition, but I don't see one that alleges that first post-conviction counsel was ineffective and that in and of itself is grounds for your second petition.
Well, I would certainly apologize if the brief was less than clear on that point. If you look starting at the petition, we have detailed allegations in the very beginning of the petition talking about each of these grounds of ineffectiveness of post-conviction counsel. In the opening brief, we cite to the Crump case, which is the controlling authority from 1997 that establishes that right. To the extent that I didn't argue it more affirmatively, I do apologize. I didn't.
No, I took the point as to the timeliness of it. I just didn't see it as a separate claim.
Well, they certainly interrelate somewhat.
Yeah.
Because the default rules, in order to overcome them, it relates to the issue of ineffective assistance.
Fair enough.
Thank you.
Further questions, colleagues? This case will stand submitted. Court will be in recess until 1:30 this afternoon.
All rise. Thank you.